WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Margalek is taking a brief break from covering the O.J. Simpson trial for the New York Times. We invited him to tell us what it's been like. Margalek also covered the trials of two other people he describes as marquee defendants, Lorena Bobbitt and William Kennedy Smith. Margalek used to write the Times legal column called At the Bar. Over 100 of those columns are collected in his new book, At the Bar, The Passions and Peccadillos of American Lawyers. As he writes in his introduction, America can't make up its mind about lawyers. It reviles them, relies upon them, respects and ridicules them. His columns documented every aspect of the changing legal profession and explored Americans' often contradictory response to lawyers. Margalek nearly became a lawyer. He studied law, but never practiced. I asked him if he considers the O.J. Simpson trial a plum assignment or hardship duty.
It's a plum assignment in the sense that everybody is paying attention to what you write. I have probably more of an audience now than I've ever had for stories before. In many other ways, it's hardship duty. I mean, personally speaking, I'm living away from home for 9 months. That's not easy. I'm writing for an East Coast deadline of a West Coast trial, which is going to extend even further now if Judge Ito's new hours are put into effect. In a sense, it's not, you know, I'm competing against the whole gamut of journalists and, you know, journalistic organs. That's very, very difficult because I can't compete against people who pay for stories. I can't compete for space, in a sense, with the local paper. I can't compete for the kind of prurient interest that a lot of journalists approach this thing with. I mean, that's just not the way that we do things. And I also have a million people second-guessing me.
About what?
You know, just if my judgments don't mesh with theirs or if I miss something, which has happened from time to time.
What was one of the big controversies behind one of your stories?
Well, I mean, I did one story. Probably the biggest controversy from any story that I've written was when I quoted the National Enquirer in one of my pieces. And, you know, the New York Times is not supposed to acknowledge that, A, that the National Enquirer or any tabloid publication exists. This is in the minds of some people. And, B, certainly not acknowledge that they've broken any stories in the case. And I didn't choose to do that. They're part of this equation. And so I put them in, and I had my head handed to me by various sort of journalistic superegos, these self-appointed critics who go around and sort of monitor media performance.
What did you quote them as saying?
Well, first of all, I did a story about them. I did a long feature story about their importance in the case. I didn't get faulted so much for that because that was more reportorial, but I quoted them. You may remember that there was some controversy over whether or not O.J. had confessed to Roosevelt Greer when Reverend Greer visited him in prison. And the Enquirer had reported that O.J. had exclaimed that he did it. They were the only ones who actually went into what O.J. purportedly said. And I thought that it was worth, I didn't build a whole story around it, but I thought that it was worth reporting. And I put that in the story. I put it sort of in the middle or toward the end of the story that I wrote, saying that, you know, there was this whole controversy over whether or not what the guards had overheard O.J. say was admissible, and that only one publication had actually reported what he had supposedly said. And that's what I was criticized for. My own feeling was that it was out there, that other people were reporting it, and that my readers could be trusted to conclude whether it was entitled to any credence or not.
Do you keep reading the tabloids to see how they're covering the O.J. trial?
You know, I read them intermittently. I probably should, if I were doing my job more conscientiously, I should read them all the time. Not because anybody is making me do it, but I think it's just, as I say, it's part of the story. Not all of them. I mean, you know, most of them report nonsense, and I wouldn't believe anything in them. But I think that the Enquirer in particular has a decent batting average on this. Now they're reporting this week about the plea bargaining, and I don't think I would have reported that because everybody is denying it, you know, including most recently Johnny Cochran, you know, on the record in court. They've reported that before. I mean, they've been wrong about some things too, but I think that a conscientious reporter should read them and maybe one or two other publications. You know, for instance, nobody wants to admit it, but the transcript of O.J.'s conversation, interview with the police, was first reported in the Star. And, you know, when people need that transcript in the press room, you'll see copies of the Star floating around, you know. We can pretend that it doesn't exist, but it's true.
How do you think your take is different? I mean, what guidelines do you work with about not just the information that you can include, but the amount of analysis that you feel you can put in?
Well, I think that's changing, too. I think that, you know, as with newspapers in general, we're becoming more analytical about everything that we write. And, I mean, we've become like sports reporters in a way. I mean, people who, you know, the person who writes about the ball game for the time, the Yankees game the night before, can't just put in a blow-by-blow description anymore because people are listening to it on the radio or watching it on television. I try to be careful about this, but I'm taking greater stylistic and analytical liberties than I would have done a few years ago.
What's an example of something analytical that you were able to say now that you think you wouldn't have said if you were covering this trial years earlier?
Well, maybe, you know, sort of putting in a paragraph about how stringing together all the various defense theories in the case. You know, the defense wants you to believe that, you know, if the defense is to be believed, drug dealers who are really out to kill Faye Resnick killed Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman by mistake. And then at that point, a police department that had always pampered O.J. Simpson instantly hatched a conspiracy to frame him. You know, just stringing together all of this stuff. I mean, laying it all out. I mean, it's all factual, but laying it all out in such a way that the tenuousness of it all is apparent to people. And not just sitting back and pretending that you know this stuff is as plausible as anything else that's being said in court. Of course, you know, you get in trouble when you do that. People. I remember I got a letter from somebody, from an angry reader saying, you know, the defense is coming up with one cockamamie theory after another. How can you know? And you report it, you know, credulously, as if this stuff is to be taken seriously. How can you do that? And I wrote him back and I said, you know, I try to put this stuff into some kind of perspective and suggest that it sounds a little bit far-fetched. I said, but if I said it any more explicitly than that, you'd be the first to accuse me of being biased.
My guest is David Margalek. He's on a brief break from covering the O.J. Simpson trial for the New York Times. He used to write the Times legal column, and those columns are collected in his new book, At the Bar. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with David Margalek. He's covering the O.J. Simpson trial for the Times, the New York Times, and has a new book called At the Bar. Do you feel that the prosecution or the defense has tried to use the press in any way?
Oh, sure. Yeah, all the time.
Do you feel like you've been used at all? Not that you've played along with it, but that someone has tried
well,
to
no,
use
I,
you.
Well, no, oh, sure. You know, I mean, we're being spun all the time, you know? I was, you know, a defense lawyer told me that they were going to file a long collection of grievances against Judge Ito. For instance, this is just one example, and I reported that, and it never happened. And I think one of the reasons it never happened is that Ito read that they were about to do it. And, you know, at least to their satisfaction, they felt he mended his ways. So in that sense, we're being used all the time. You know, and we're using them, I suppose, in the same way. It's just inherent in the business. I don't resent them for it. You know, that's just part of that's how it's done.
You know, you write in your new book that these celebrity trials have created a new breed of lawyer commentators who are really becoming quite famous now.
It's absolutely true. In fact, one of the commentators had a party the other night here in Los Angeles for his fellow commentators, and he came up with a term for us, the commentocracy. There's a whole commentocracy here. There are many of them. Many of these lawyers are going to have to be dragged kicking and screaming back to the practice of law. They're never going to want to do it. I mean, this new glamorous life is just too hard to resist. I know of several people, in fact, who are planning alternative new careers as commentators.
Oh, that's interesting. Have you ever served on a jury?
You know, it's funny that you ask. I did once. I did, and it was a fascinating experience.
What kind of case was it?
It was a murder case. It was a murder case in New York City, and I got my notice for jury duty. And I felt for sure that given my background and my work, I would never be allowed to stay on the jury. And when they were in the middle of the voir dire, I was called down to the bench. And the two lawyers consented and the judge consented. And I think it was because they thought that I would write about it. And they weren't necessarily averse to that possibility. You know, I mean, for them, it was just a garden variety case. For me, it was very exciting. And I must say, very reassuring about the jury. I have great faith in juries. I suppose I'm naive about that, too. But I know how I have some insight into how conscientiously a jury can perform. And this was a very interesting case about a mailman in Harlem who was caught in a crossfire between drug dealers. And it was very sad. It was very moving. And the only people in the courtroom were the wife and the children of the man who died.
What did you learn about juries or about yourself as a juror that made you feel so good about the jury system?
Well, I just I sat among these people and I heard how deliberate and attentive they were, and how seriously they took their jobs. There were people in there who were sort of holding out, who wanted to make sure that the defendant, who was, you know, the kind of person that one might think a jury of middle class people wouldn't care about. He was sort of a drug runner, and didn't make any difference. There were people who were looking out for him. It happened to be an easy case because the defendant had not actually pulled the trigger, but he was part of the transaction, and so his intent became less important. It was much simpler. And that's eventually what it went out on. We convicted him, but it was sort of an easy case. And yet at the same time, there were people who were extremely reluctant to do it and had to be convinced. And that's what's supposed to go on in a jury room.
Do you think the Times is giving more room to the famous cases of the day, whether it's, you know, Bobbitt or William Kennedy Smith or O.J. Simpson, than they might have in the past?
My inclination is to say yes, and that once upon a time, they never would have covered something like the Bobbitt case. In fact, there were two Bobbitt trials, and we barely covered the first one. And I was sort of parachuted in in the middle of the second one. I think that, you know, there was some uncertainty as to whether or not this thing was important or not. You know, I mean, one doesn't have that kind of question with O.J., but there was no great legal principle involved in the Bobbitt case, and yet at the same time, the whole world was talking about it. And I think that poses a problem for the mainstream press.
What's the problem?
Well, the problem is, you know, you don't want to get caught up in this undertow, and you don't want to just write about titillating but ultimately insignificant things. But by definition, if everybody is talking about something socially, it's significant. And so you compromise, and you send somebody in late, and you vow not to cover it unless there's something significant happening in the case, you know, that can be elevated into a more important legal question. And then, you know, as it turned out in the Bobbitt case, when the verdict came back, when the jury came back and let her off, it was the off lead in the paper, which is a technical term for saying it was above the fold on the left-hand side with a picture. It was the second most important story in the paper that day. So that's the evolution that often happens.
Listen, you know, one thing that everybody will always remember about the Lorena Bobbitt trial is that it was the first time network anchors said the word penis during newscasts.
Right.
How did you handle that? Did you have any guidelines about that?
I think that for a time the rules were relaxed a little bit, and it made its way into the paper much more freely than it ever had before, including in at least one instance a headline. I think that probably the pendulum has swung back some, but it's no longer verboten.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can use it. I also remember that during the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill business, when Long Dong Silver was being, you know, was part of the story,
mm-hmm.
newspapers couldn't ignore it, and it had to be in there. You know, it was part of the story. And so for a while, people, you know, it was finding its way into stories, but reporters granted a little bit of license were working it in gratuitously into unrelated stories. And a memo came around saying, cool it with Long Dong Silver.
David Margalek, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's my pleasure, Terry.
David Margalek covers the O.J. Simpson trial for the New York Times. His new book, At the Bar, is a collection of the legal columns he wrote for the Times. This is Fresh Air.